Hello and welcome to our podcast, Baby Baking and Kid Raising, hosted by myself, Eliza Carr, a passionate midwife, new mama and founder of Bump and Bub, as well as my co-host, Dr. Joseph Scorry, an obstetrician, gynecologist and fertility specialist, as well as a dad of three. Together, we will be discussing topics from fertility through to parenthood and everything in between. Each week, we will be joined by inspiring guests who share their own journeys through fertility, pregnancy, birth and parenthood, as well as educational episodes from us, a midwife and an obstetrician. This episode is sponsored by Once Upon. In today's episode, we sit down with the lovely Erin. Erin is a first-time mum to her one-year-old daughter, Lucy. Alongside the incredible journey of motherhood, Erin is a full-time content creator and businesswoman, appearing on Mecca storefronts and Nivea advertisements on London taxis. Erin shares such relatable and vulnerable topics around motherhood, business, and life struggles in general, which is so important on social media, especially in the motherhood space. In today's episode, we're going to chat about Erin's journey through pregnancy, birth, and the postpartum, all while sharing her journey on an online platform. So welcome to the podcast, Erin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our daughters are the same, almost exactly the same age, days apart. So it's been amazing to have that distant connection. I know we're definitely in different cities, but it's been nice to kind of walk this journey together. So to start off today's episode, can you tell us a bit about yourself, where you live, and who is in your family?
Yeah, so I live in Brisbane with my husband Ben, daughter Lucy, and fur baby Cooper. I'm a full-time content creator. So I've been working on social media for the last 7 years, just creating content for brands. I kind of started in the beauty space doing mostly makeup and skincare stuff. And then I think as my life has kind of transitioned into different stages and, you know, becoming a mum and sharing all of that, it has, my work has transitioned with it. So now I'm lucky to have a really, really great community of mums that follow me. And yeah, I love, this is why I'm excited for this podcast, because I love talking about everything to do with motherhood and like birth, pregnancy. I didn't know how much I'd love it until I became a mum myself and fell pregnant. And I just think it's the most beautiful thing. So it's really exciting that I get to do that as a job and share it with the world as well.
Joe and I have talked about this before, but it's incredible the careers that have kind of stemmed from content creation. And, you know, you've achieved such incredible things globally. And I guess, you know, you and I have chatted about this before, but it's such a incredible job when you have a child and you can be at home with your bubba. Talk to us a little bit about that journey. And obviously you've shared so much of your life online, which has been amazing. I feel like I know you very well, even though we've never met in person, but that's the beauty of following people online.
That is the beauty of it. I feel like it's like when I started 7 years ago, it was a really bizarre thing because people would say to you, like, what do you do for work? And you would have to, I never really knew how to answer it because no one knew what it was or what it meant to be a content creator or working on social media. So there's been a massive shift in the last 7 years of like how well recognized my job in this industry is. And I mean, I never responded well to working for other people. I always knew that I wanted to work for myself. And like both of my parents are business owners. They own their own businesses and do their own thing. And I think I just wanted to follow in those footsteps and have that independence myself. But I didn't know in what realm. So I just had a passion for makeup and sharing my life. And I think it just like I fell into it really, really naturally and started gaining a following that would then ask me to do makeup tutorials and would ask me to, you know, what products are you using? And it just organically and very naturally happened. And I think they started following me for not just for my makeup, it was for me. And that's why I've been able to transition through my life and, you know, share becoming a mum and share, you know, I've moved into state and I've done all of these things, traveling the world, and all of that has been documented online and my following has just gone with that. And I think, you know, people grow with you. Like when they started following me for my makeup, they were probably around the same age as me. And so naturally our lives have kind of progressed at the same times. And so when I, you know, fall pregnant, get engaged, get married, they're all going through the same stages of life with me, which is really amazing because I feel like it's just this little community that you know, I almost feel like I'm best friends with all of these people, even though I've never met them. But like you said, Eliza, it's just the beauty of social media. You connect really, really well with people just through a screen.
I tried it as well and failed. So that's why I'm an obstetrician gynecologist. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was more your time factor.
Oh, the
you
time.
You don't really have the time that you're too busy catching babies. Obviously, our girls were very close in age. And I remember us just cheering each other on so much in the final weeks of pregnancy in those early days. What was your pregnancy like with Lucy, and how did you and Ben feel about the prospect of getting pregnant? Can you talk to us about that whole kind of beginning motherhood journey?
Yeah, so it was a very exciting thing for us. I have always dreamt of becoming a mum. It's just something I remember. I've seen you actually talk about this, Eliza. When you started dating Stuart, you were very much just like, babies, babies, babies.
Like, I was like, so I'm 21, but you know, like, what are you thinking about?
I was the exact same. And poor Ben was so scared because he was just like, not even like, hadn't even put any thought into it. But so we have been together for 12 years and we met when we were 17. So we were very young, especially to be talking about starting a family. Like, you know, most people aren't thinking that far ahead, but I was, because I was just, I'm so excited to grow my family and be a mum. So anyway, down the track, we got engaged 10 years later and we were planning our wedding, and right smack bang in the middle of COVID, our wedding got postponed. And it was really such a strange time because the wedding for us was like, we're going to get married and then we're going to start our family. And so when the wedding got postponed, it felt like our whole life was being postponed. And so there was, it was quite upsetting because we were like, what do we do? Do we start trying for a baby now and, you know, deal with the wedding later down the track? Like, so many people were in this situation. I've spoken to so many women that were feeling the exact same way and, you know, have always had this goal of wanting to fall pregnant before they're 30, or, you know, they got a timeline in mind. And when this huge thing shifts that timeline, you've got to really adapt and figure out what you're going to do. So we just decided we weren't going to let the pandemic control our lives. And so our wedding got cancelled the week before we were due to get married. And so we just said, you know what, like, let's just continue with our lives. Let's try for a family and see what happens. And we were really lucky to fall pregnant very fast. So about 6 weeks later, I got the positive pregnancy test, and I emailed my wedding venue and said, can we please postpone for a lot longer now? Because, yeah, we're going to be having a baby. So it was very exciting. It was a very big whirlwind because we, for a while there, had no idea what was going to be happening with our lives, as so many people were experiencing in COVID. So yeah, it was a very exciting time, but also a very emotional time with everything else going on as well.
It's actually interesting you say that, that people moved on from, you know, thinking about the possibility of having a wedding, and then quickly realized that, of course, that wasn't going to happen during COVID. And so then they moved on to wanting to have a baby. And a lot of my own patients, I think, had expedited their plans for pregnancy due to COVID. So if there's one positive that came out of it, was a hell of a lot of babies that would have otherwise not have been around.
Yeah, definitely. I actually had a lot of people kind of say to me, like, there was that whole the pandemic babies type thing. Like, I've had people say, oh, you're one of the people that had a pandemic baby, or like, you were just that bored in lockdown. And to be completely honest, sometimes it has triggered me because I'm like, well, no, because I would have had a, like, regardless of the pandemic, I wanted to have a baby anyway. Like,
just brought forward that timeline
just,
a bit.
Yeah, it's just changed the timeline. But like, I wasn't just bored. I wanted her and I wanted to start a family. So, but it's funny because so many people were in a similar situation. And I think that's potentially why I've connected with so many women on social media. Like, I've had hundreds of messages from people that were in the exact same position. So, yeah, it happened to so many of us.
It did, yeah, absolutely. And what was your pregnancy journey like? I know for me it was, even though we were kind of to the middle towards the end of COVID-ish, it was still super scary and isolating, and there was all the rules and stuff in place which did impact, you know, our pregnancies and the journey that we had. Tell us about the care that you had. What were you going through the hospital system? A bit more about that.
So I always wanted to do some sort of midwifery program. I just wanted to feel quite supported. I guess any first-time mum, it's a very scary thing falling pregnant for the first time. Like, you don't know what to expect. And so I think for my own like anxiety in the whole situation, I felt more comfortable being like having that support from a midwife the whole way through. But unfortunately, my local hospital, their midwifery program, they are very particular with who they let into it. I think it's very much just for high risk pregnancies, and it's a very small amount of people that they allow into the program. So from very early on, I was told that wasn't going to be an option for me, and that I had just had to go through GP shared care. But I was really struggling with my GP. She was chopping and changing all the time between different clinics. And so I would have an appointment booked in to see her, and then a day before I would get told that she wasn't going to be there anymore and I was going to be seeing someone new. And it was just, I wasn't getting that continuity of care that I wanted in such like a vulnerable, strange time for me. So I ended up going back to the hospital and saying, like, what are my other options? Because I want a midwife. I want someone that specializes in pregnancy that can, you know, I can talk to about this stuff and feel reassured. So they put me onto I don't know if this is, again, I obviously have only ever done this once. I don't know what other hospitals are like, but they put me on like an antenatal program where I was seeing midwives for every appointment, but it was a different midwife. So it was just whoever was kind of on at the time. And it was through the hospital, but not at the hospital, if that makes sense. It was at like a different clinic. And to be honest, it wasn't my preferred form of care, but it was like the best option for me at the time with, you know.
Yeah, the options that were available.
Yeah.
It's such a hard thing to navigate, and Joe and I have spoken about this many times, and we know that continuity of care is the gold standard. It's what every woman should receive. And, you know, whether it's through private obstetric care, whether it's through private or public midwife, and it's such a shame that so many women don't get to have that kind of continuity. And it's why so many people did and do choose private a lot of the time, because it's, you know, that continuity and that one-to-one is just so, so, so important. And unfortunately, it often gets lost in the public system. And I was that midwife, Erin, who was, you know, who worked in the antenatal clinics, and I'd see a different woman every time, and I would feel a sense of guilt, and I'd feel like, you know, you have to explain your situation to me every time for this 20-minute appointment. But it's a super tough one.
I think it's important to acknowledge that the public sector does exceptionally well, but we've got to also understand that there's always a different level of care. It's a little bit like if you're doing orthopedic surgery. If you're going to see a surgeon at the public hospital, you're going to have a range of different skill levels and a skill mix. You're going to have the junior registrar, the resident, and then also the consultant around you. And at the time of operating, in actual fact, it may be the junior doctor that's actually operating on you. That's a given. And of course, because of the impost in terms of length of time, wait times, of course, time to surgery is also delayed. And it's true in every aspect of healthcare, whether it be in the public sector. It just takes that little bit longer, and it can't be the be all and end all that we really want, because otherwise, as taxpayers, we'd be spending a hell of a lot of money. And that's why I think we're very fortunate in Australia to have this two-tiered level system, because whilst most people might poo-poo the private sector, it also actually puts less pressure on the public sector, because as people move away from the private sector to engage with private consultants, admittedly having to pay additionally for their care, they're actually getting seen a lot quicker. Yeah, sure, but they're actually then not putting a huge impost on our public sector. And so we would all love to be able to have the same sort of continuity of care with respect to the women who are in having pregnancy during the public care sector. But of course, that would cost a hell of a lot of money. And the mere fact is that that just would be not sustainable, and we couldn't provide the level of service across the whole board. So that's why some people, as Eliza alluded to, decide to go privately, and that then gives that additional level of, well, we shouldn't say care. The care is identical. It's that additional level of support. It becomes more a service.
Continuity.
Becomes more a service.
Yeah.
Do you know, in all honesty, I've had people ask me now, would I stick with public for my next pregnancy or would I choose to go private? And I would still stick with public because even though at the time when I was choosing which type of care I wanted to go through, I didn't get what I wanted, I ended up having a really beautiful experience. Like every midwife that I did come across was lovely. They gave me the support that I needed. It was more, I guess, what Eliza touched on. Like you just have to kind of give your whole 20-minute spiel of like, this is my situation. This is what I've been, you know, doing so far in pregnancy. So you just don't have that type of continuity, but the actual care was unreal. And so I have absolutely nothing bad to say. I think, and that's the thing with Australia, we are so lucky that our public system is so great compared to a lot of other places.
Actually, I was talking about this on Bump and Bub yesterday or the day before, and I was talking about the importance of going into your healthcare provider or if you're going through the public system, giving your delivery ward a call if you have any concerns about movements and how important that is. And something I didn't even think about when I was saying it, which is obviously such a place of privilege that we live here, was, you know, a woman commented and said, yes, but in the US where I am, it costs me about $1,000 every time I go into the delivery ward. I have no insurance. It costs me $1,000 every time I need to go and check on my child, and I need to weigh up the options here.
That's wild.
I can't afford it. What do I do? And I was like, holy heck. And I had to sit there for a hot minute and be like, oh my gosh, like that. We're literally so, so lucky to have this incredible system here. So,
and that's the thing. We don't even have to think twice about stuff like that, because we are so lucky. We can just arrive at the hospital and we'll get the care that we need.
We'll get exceptional care. Yeah.
Yeah.
So with your pregnancy, how was your pregnancy journey with Lucy? Did you know she was a girl? Did you know it was Lucy?
Yeah. So I was really, really sick in my first trimester. Literally from, I think, 6 weeks, I was just vomiting nonstop every day. And when I wasn't vomiting, I was nauseous to the point where I was like, at any point I'm gonna have my head in the toilet again. So I said to Ben, I really want to do the NIPT test and find out the gender, because I feel like that's just giving me something to really look forward to at the moment, because right now life just feels really dreary and difficult, feeling so sick that I just needed that little bit of like excitement, and finding out the gender for me was that. So we did the NIPT and we found out, just Ben and I sitting on our lounge room floor. The doctor sent through the report via an email, and we sat there and we read it. And that was just like, I don't know what it was. I felt a lot more connected to my pregnancy, and I just had a lot more give in me after that, knowing that, you know, it was a girl and I could refer to her as a girl and talk about all the things that we were going to do with her. And for me, it was just my way of kind of getting through the crappy first trimester. But then as soon as I hit 16 weeks, it was like someone clicked a button and nausea, vomiting, everything just stopped. And I had the most incredible pregnancy from there. So I feel really lucky, because I know obviously a lot of women struggle, you know, with HG and, you know, a lot of other things during pregnancy. And yeah, I feel very lucky that at 16 weeks it just stopped for me and I could really enjoy myself from there.
I think a lot of people can relate to that. I've heard so many women say that when they feeling just so crappy. I was the same, just so, so, so sick in those first few months. And knowing the gender for a lot of people, knowing the sex for a lot of people, it gives you like a little bit more oomph to kind of keep going and visualize. And so yeah, I think that's beautiful. So the remainder of your pregnancy was smooth, easy. Well, easy, sorry, shouldn't choose that word, should I? But smooth and beautiful, smooth, as you've said. Yeah,
it was smooth. I had a few little extra scans because Lucy was measuring really big. I think she was on the 89th percentile. And so when I went in for my 20-week morphology scan, they kind of flagged her as a bigger baby and said that I was just going to need some extra scans and monitoring later in pregnancy. So I think I had another scan at 32 weeks and then again at 36 weeks. My 32-week scan, she was still measuring really, really big. And then at 36 weeks, they said she had kind of slowed down. So her growth had kind of plateaued out, which I'm not surprised because she surely was running out of room in there. Like I was carrying so big. I couldn't understand how she could keep growing. It was a bit tricky because I guess this goes hand in hand with what I was talking about with the care that I was getting. Every different midwife that I would see would kind of have a different opinion on the whole big baby situation. So, you know, I would go to one antenatal appointment and one midwife would say to me, you should consider being induced early because she's measuring really big. And then I would go to another appointment 2 weeks later and a different midwife would say, you know, you don't have to be induced early. If you don't want to, do what you feel is right. You can go full term. And I was getting some pretty mixed opinions from the healthcare team about what I should do. And again, just being my first pregnancy, I don't know what is right or wrong in this situation. All I can go off of is the medical advice that I'm being given.
It is different. I mean, I think medicine is, and you know, midwifery is an art, and how we practice our trade is based on not only our clinical what we've learnt in terms of book study, but also our clinical experience. So, for me, for example, you know, I've got a catalogue of 330 odd births I do a year, where I sort of in my mind know exactly. I've seen this situation before, so I can predict, in a way. You know, I can look at a woman and say to her, I can see where you're at and I can see what's happening with your baby and I can sort of guess in a way because of a catalogue of information that's stored in my brain, despite the fact that there might be evidence that's behind us. So, you know, as much as there is science, there's also an art. And certainly with, you know, with respect to her big babies, there is differing opinions. And in actual fact, probably with respect to actually an induction of labour, it is really a joint decision between mother and also their caregiver in terms of whether you want to be induced. But I always talk about sort of four P's when it comes to going through labour. And there's a couple of things that we can control and a couple of things that we can't control. So the four P's are, for example, the placenta. You know, the placenta is it's continuing to evolve over the course of the pregnancy. And we know that the placenta is really required in terms of an oxygen-rich support supply to the baby to be there during that labouring process. And as the pregnancy advances, that placenta becomes a little bit older, so that we know that if you go into labour, that if you the younger the baby, sort of in terms of gestation at 39, 40 weeks, it's a lot younger. And in terms of the ability for it to cope with the rigours of labour, rather, it's a lot better than, say, a placenta at 42 weeks. Then the next thing is the passenger. The passenger is the baby, the size of the baby. And as every week goes by, the baby puts on more and more weight. So if we've got a baby that's coming out at 39 weeks, that's obviously going to be a bit smaller than at 40 weeks and certainly a lot smaller than 41 weeks. So again, we can control the size of the passenger by saying, hey, let's be induced. But there's a couple of things we can't control, and that's the passage, the size of the pelvis. That's fixed. That's going to be there the whole time. That's not going to change whether you're at 39 weeks, 40 or 41 weeks. And the other thing we can't change, of course, is power, how well a woman will push during the labouring process. So there are a couple of factors that are within our control, a couple of factors that are without our control. And one of the things that social media doesn't do well is it instills, or in fact it does this, it instills a huge amount of fear about birth and birth options, whether it be home birth, whether it be free birth, whether it be birthing in a hospital, whether it be induced, whether it be this medical cascade of intervention that everyone talks about. It's just a choice of care. And what you choose after a very well-informed decision by getting all the information from all your different healthcare providers is ultimately the choice that you want. And so when you sit down with someone, and that's probably the element of consistency that we were talking about before, that if you've got this trusted individual that you see on a regular basis, and it becomes there, and it becomes more important, not when you're having a pregnancy that's, you know, let's be honest, reasonably stock standard, yeah? Yes, you may have had a baby that was bigger, but if you've got complications that are occurring within pregnancy, you can see what happens in the public sector as much as it happens in the private sector is you immediately go to one person, and that one person becomes the focal point for your information and curation of that information so that you provided consistent medical advice or midwifery advice. And that's the difference. That's the difference where things come in, that when you're starting to get to the pointy end and you're finding so much different information, you actually need one person to sit you down and explain things. And that can happen in the public sector as much as it can happen in the private sector. And you do need to be a good advocate for yourself when you are in the public sector, because if you feel like you're getting conflicting information, if you feel like your care is not what you would expect, just arc up and speak about it, because they will get you to speak to someone who will then provide that level of comfort and support in terms of your decision making.
It's so funny that you, mentioning the impact of social media on pregnancy and birth and some of the negative and confusing information out there. I think having the platform that I have, when I was sharing my pregnancy online and, you know, I was getting all of this information about a big baby and the potential of needing to be induced at 38 weeks, I was sharing all of this online because people were so interested in my journey. But in response, I was getting a lot of real everyday people giving me their personal experiences in these situations as well. And I actually had one message from a girl that really stood out to me at the time. And she said she had been through a very similar experience where she was being told she had a very big baby, and that she was going to need to be induced, but she just kept reminding herself that her body is growing this baby and her body is capable of birthing that baby. And I'd never thought of it in that, you know, in that way before. And I guess it just took that medical professional, very, you know, this is how it should be type of thought process out of it for me. And I started really thinking about my gut feeling and my intuition and really listening to my body in that situation. And I feel like that's when I started to get some sense in my head about what I wanted out of the pregnancy, because I just had so many conflicting things before that. I wasn't listening to what I wanted. And so I think from there, I went to my next midwife appointment and I started really advocating for myself. And that's when I started to get a really clear mind of how I wanted my birth to look and what I wanted out of it. And then I felt like I was getting the support from the healthcare team that I wanted. But it was just because we were on different pages before then, because I couldn't give them a clear idea of what I was after. So when you said advocating for yourself and stuff like that, it is so true. And I didn't do that early enough. And I in hindsight, probably should have done that earlier on. So, yeah, because once I did, it all kind of went smoothly from there and I felt like I was getting the support I needed.
Amazing. This week's sponsor is Once Upon, a beautiful company with the vision of celebrating life and capturing memories and moments that matter. If you're like me, your phone is full to the brim of thousands of photos of your life, the big moments and the small moments. When I became a mother, I realized that actually the small moments are the big moments. I never want to forget my daughter's smile when she sees a banana or a plane, or the uncontrollable giggles when a little sausage dog walks past, or even the way she puts her hands high in the air when I say, "How tall are you?" I know my memories of these moments will fade, and like all of us, I desperately try to capture them on my phone. I have loved and used Once Upon to create photo books with our treasured memories. I love pulling photos off my phone and just into a tangible photo book that I can quite literally sit there with my daughter and go through. You can download the super easy to use app on the App Store or on Google Play. Upload your favorite photos, include some captions or memories if you wanted to, and send it off to print. It's so simple. There's nothing more beautiful than opening your postbox to see the highest quality, gorgeously designed book filled with moments you want to remember for an absolute lifetime. They also make the best gift. Use code BBKR for 25% off your first purchase and see the show notes for more below. And so what did your birth look like with Lucy? I know you shared a beautiful video.
It was amazing. I feel very, very lucky. I look back on that whole 24 hours and it's just the most beautiful memory. It didn't go to plan, but I very much went into birth knowing that it's probably not going to go to plan. I didn't have a super rigid idea in my head. I was quite flexible. I actually was due to be induced at 41+3. And at 1 a.m. that morning, my waters broke. So she knew. And I was just so relieved because I wasn't against the idea of an induction, but it wasn't my ideal situation. So I've never been so relieved to have fluid go all over my bedroom floor. I was literally on my exercise ball bouncing up and down because I was feeling really strange. I had some cramping and some really like intense tightenings in my stomach and I couldn't sleep. So I was just up at the end of the bed bouncing on my exercise ball, leaning over it, just trying to get in any position to feel more comfortable. And all of a sudden they just burst. And like, I know some women talk about it just being a little trickle or, you know, it can be different for everyone. Mine, I had no doubt my waters had broken. It's very obvious. So yeah, I was so excited and I called the hospital straight away and just explained that, you know, I was 41+3, my waters had just broken. They wanted me to come in just so that they could check that it was my waters and check, I think because I was quite overdue, they wanted to check for meconium and stuff like that, which I had done a lot of research on and I was pretty confident like that everything was okay. But they said, come in and then we'll send you back home and you can continue laboring at home. And I think from my house to the hospital, we probably got there within half an hour. And in that half an hour, my contractions just ramped up so much. I was getting, I think every 3 or 4 minutes, I was getting contractions and they were lasting about 50 seconds to 60 seconds. So I got to the hospital and they said to me, okay, no, you're staying, you're not going home, because it had just ramped up so fast. So yeah, they admitted me straight away into the birthing suite and I did my thing and set up all my, you know, my little fake candles everywhere. I had my own pillow. I really wanted the space to feel comfortable for me. I'd done a lot of research into, you know, oxytocin and how that can kind of help during labor. And so I wanted to set up a space that made me feel really comfortable. I've never spent much time in hospitals myself. So hospitals to me have always felt like a very sterile, scary environment. And that was probably my biggest fear in labor, is getting there and being in such a strange, uncomfortable environment, but having to keep myself really calm and at peace. And
it's great that you did bring all those things and make it a really homely or comfortable environment. It's super
important. And I do feel like it made a huge difference because I ended up spending 24 hours in that one room. And, you know, if I didn't have those things, I don't know what it would have looked like. So, unfortunately I did. It took me a while to progress. So when I first got in there, I was only 1 centimeter dilated. It felt really bizarre because my contractions were so intense and so frequent, but nothing was really happening anywhere else. And so even the midwives were a little bit confused. I think they even thought that I was going to be further along in terms of dilation, just based on the frequency of the contractions. It was quite a very long day. They did the cervical checks every few hours. I mean, my hospital, I know every hospital is different, but they had said to me that they wanted to see me progressing at least 2 centimeters, I think, every 4 hours. And particularly because my waters had broken, they were obviously keeping a very close eye on the clock. And I did end up having to get a dose of antibiotics because I think it was something like 14, 15 hours later. I was still only about, I think I was about 6 centimeters dilated at that point. And so we didn't know how much longer I was going to be in labor. So they administered the first dose of antibiotics, obviously due to risk of infection. So it was a very slow, slow process. But, you know, I kind of, with my pain relief, I, in my birth plan, wasn't opposed to getting an epidural or using pain relief, but my own personal goal, I guess, was just to see how far I could get and how much I could endure before choosing pain relief. So I think for the first maybe 12 hours, I just tried to keep moving, you know, showers, stuff like that, getting into different positions, exercise ball. I also used a TENS machine, which I absolutely loved. I know some people don't love TENS machines during labor, but I just think it was the best thing ever. But after about 12 hours, I was just so exhausted. And so I said I was mentally so drained. I hadn't slept because obviously my waters broke at 1 a.m. I'd basically done an all-nighter and
a marathon at that.
Yeah. And I just said, like, I had always said to Ben that the point that I'm going to ask for an epidural is when I feel like I'm that mentally drained, that there's a chance I'm not going to be very present when Lucy does enter the world. And at the end of the day, all I want is to, you know, remember that moment of her coming into the world and feeling really present and really like alert during that. And so that was my, I said, I want the epidural because I'm just so exhausted and I feel like I can't have that unless I get the epidural. So I loved the epidural. It, the process from asking for the epidural to getting the epidural was probably two of the most excruciating hours of my life. I think just like knowing that it's coming, but you know, you don't have it yet. And the process of getting the epidural while you're in that much pain, and getting those contractions so frequently, I just remember I was not myself in that. I think I was bawling my eyes out the whole time. I was really at peak emotions. And then the epidural hit and I just felt so calm all of a sudden. And I really felt like at that point I was going to continue having the birth that I wanted. So, yeah, the epidural for me was beautiful. I really loved getting it.
It just gives you a chance to catch your breath as well and just rest before pushing as well, especially when it's been going on for a really long time and you're just shattered.
Yeah, definitely. It was I just can't imagine trying to push through without it. And I know so many women do it, and yeah, I still want to try for my next birth. I think, like, I still have that want in my body to try and do it naturally next time. But again, I'm not opposed to the pain relief because it does have a really good place.
And look, and obviously, I'm a doctor, and I come from a very different perspective. But you know, I think the notion that you've built up this expectation in your own mind that naturally means that there's nothing that you need, you know, you don't naturally extract a tooth. You don't, you know, there is a reason why we live in 2023 and we don't live in 1223. There's a reason, because we've advanced in terms of our culture, in terms of our society and the things around us, but also medicine has afforded us wonderful luxuries in terms of our healthcare. You don't get any gold star just because you've gone through birth with an epidural or not an epidural. You've given birth behind, you know, in a bath in your home. There's no gold star. It's what you choose. But and so, you know, the fact that if you get to the point, like you said, you know, I need to have an epidural, then have an epidural. I mean, some of the best births I've seen, you know, there was a woman who who decided, you know, straight from second baby, third baby, Joe, as soon as I come into labor, I want an epidural. And she had an epidural, sat there. She actually worked while she was still doing in labor, and then she pushed the baby out. And for her, it was, and look, not every woman's the same, of course, but for her it was effortless and it was everything that she desired. Equally so, you can build yourself up and say, oh, geez, you know what, I don't want to have an epidural because I'll feel like I've failed myself and I haven't achieved what, you know, so many women before me have done before. But the reality of the situation is labor is quite painful. And a lot of people say, oh, you're male, you don't understand. How can a male possibly dictate healthcare to women? It's like an oncologist, in a way, dictating healthcare for people in terms of their cancer treatment. They don't need to have cancer. And one of the things that I think maybe being male affords me is the luxury to step back and say, God, what's happening in front of me? Yeah. Am I influenced by the social burden that women have in terms of the constant influences around them about what they should be expecting during their childbirth? And I can sit back, and sometimes I remember there was one lady who had come in with her doula and her husband, and the instructions, and I had known the instructions as well, mind you, was that she was not to have an epidural. There was no way. She just didn't want an epidural because in her mind that was going to be a failure. And I remember, and I'm sure Holly will be happy if she gets her name mentioned here, but I remember her being in labor, and it was, for me as a caregiver, it was like watching someone at Guantanamo Bay being tortured, right? So I walked into the room and I said to her, Holly, is there anything I can do for you? Do you need any pain relief? Didn't say epidural, just said pain relief, right? So that could have been Panadol, Panadine for gas, could have been water, injections, it could have been a whole range of things. And both the husband and the doula said, no, she doesn't need anything. So, okay, well, that's fair enough. She had her advocates there with her. I came back about an hour and a half, 2 hours later, and again, it was really difficult. I mean, I find it really difficult seeing people in pain. It's like seeing your child in pain, or seeing your wife in pain, or your partner in pain. If you're a partner looking at your partner who's having childbirth, and I said to her again, and this time the doula and the husband once again answered for her, and this time around I said, no, Holly, I need to know. What do you want? And she said, Joe, I need something. I need an epidural. And so she went in and had an epidural. And I remember she had and people talk about this whole notion, and I've been sort of having a few trolls on my Instagram, so that's hence why I'm sort of voicing these things today. But a lot of people talking about this cascade of medical intervention, bang, 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 now I've got an epidural, it's going to end up being an assisted vaginal birth, I'll end up with a Caesar. Look, she did end up having an assisted vaginal birth. But one of the things, and two of the things actually, that both her doula, her husband, and also she said was that was the most beautiful birth experience they had at the end, because they were present, she was present, not in this huge amount of pain, and she just felt like she could actually enjoy bringing her baby into the world. So not that I think, you do not need to have an epidural during childbirth, but the whole premise that it will somehow influence how you will then think about your birth. If you're open to all the options that are available to you, you'll realize that then in actual fact that whole process is merely just a way of bringing the most precious thing into the world out, and you can be confident that's the best decision for you. So I always find it difficult when people shut themselves down, and rather than say, hey, listen, I'm open to everything, and whatever happens and whatever comes my way is really important. And that's the premise of, you know, I think how we should approach women's care, in particular in relation to childbirth. It is a choice. You choose a whole range of different options, and just be open to the options if they present, and don't be locked into one particular area, because I think by doing so, we raise expectations, and we also potentially lead to a sense of failure if it's not achieved.
I actually had a midwife quite early on explain something very similar to what you've just said, Joe. And she said to me, you know, start thinking about your birth plan. But if I can just say one thing, is keep an open mind and try not to be too rigid, because when you she said she's seen it a number of times before in births when women go in with a very rigid plan. It almost has the opposite effect on their experience because they have such high expectations on themselves that they put all this pressure and these expectations that are just not realistic. You're in a high stress, you know, mental state for your entire labor, and then you don't end up progressing the way that you might if you just kind of let your body do what it needs to do and all of this stuff. Like, and I think her saying that to me made me realize that I do need to just keep an open mind. And on my birth plan, I said my preference is to not have an epidural, but if it comes to it, I want to ask for it. I don't want the midwife or the doctors to come in and say, I think you need an epidural. I want it to be my choice coming from me. And I think now in hindsight, having been through it, I'm so proud of myself for what I, you know, how I advocated for myself in that situation and being open to the pain relief, even though, you know, people were asking me at the start of my pregnancy, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't want the epidural. Like, I don't want it. But my perspective has changed so much now because of situations, you know, like that, where now I know I was so present when Lucy came into the world and it really had a good place in my birth story.
It's such a big topic, and
it's huge.
It's a massive topic, and if we kind of delve into it now, I'm sure we could talk about it for a long time. I guess I'm not completely of that agreeing completely in that sense, and I think there's a little bit of differing opinions or whatnot with midwives and obstetricians generally. In this realm, a lot of the time for me, I was that woman. I was dead set I wasn't going to get an epidural, and for me personally, the epidural was the worst experience of my life. But I understand that was a very rare complication. But I think the thing it comes down to is knowing your options, knowing how to advocate for yourself, and never, ever, ever, ever feeling like, and I was a prime example, there is no failing in birth. There literally is no failing in birth. You cannot fail in birth. So I think that's where it comes down to. You know, if you're dead set against an epidural, good on you. You know, if you want to go that route, which was the route that I hoped to go for, that's okay. But as long as you know that whatever unravels isn't a reflection of your own capabilities in any way, shape, or form. So you had the epidural. For you, it was a really beautiful and positive experience. It kind of brought you back to the moment, gave you a bit of a chance to rest. So then, yeah, how did the rest of it unfold?
So the rest of it was very relaxing. I got to lay in bed, have some dinner. Ben and I just kind of put on a movie, watched that. The midwife, I think she left the room for about an hour and a half, 2 hours, while Ben and I just had some time with each other. But when she came back, unfortunately, my contractions had slowed right down because of the epidural, and everything was just very stagnant now. So my midwife suggested Pitocin to try and speed things back up and get the contractions happening again. So at that point, I was like, yep, let's do it. Let's do whatever I need to do to meet this baby. Like, I was just at that point where I was like, get this baby out of me. I just want to meet her already. So yeah, we did the Pitocin. That seemed to boost them right back up. And then I think it was maybe another hour and a half of just relaxing. And I said to the midwife, I'm feeling a lot of pressure. Even though I had the epidural, I could still feel, I guess a lot of people would understand this if they've had an epidural. You can't feel pain, you can't feel, you know, much, but you can still feel this like pressure almost in your bum and your pelvis. And I said to her, something feels different. And so she did she said to me, do you want me to do a cervical check? Because we're not due for one for another half an hour or an hour. And I said, yeah, if that's okay, can you? Because something's telling me that I'm ready. And so she checked, but she was a student midwife. And when she did the check, she wasn't allowed to say to me in that moment
what she was feeling,
whether I was 8, 9, 10 centimeters dilated. So she had to leave the room and get one of the other midwives to come in and kind of confirm what she had done. And so this next midwife came in and did the cervical check, looked at the student midwife, gave her the thumbs up, and then the student midwife looked at me and she goes, you're ready to push. And I just remember the relief like it just felt like I'd been waiting for this moment for so long. It felt like one day, 24 hours was like a week long, you know, expedition type thing. And so, yeah, it was just the best feeling. And yeah, she kind of, I think my body was naturally just starting to push because she said she could already see Lucy's head. And yeah, I think I pushed for about 40 minutes, assisted. I had the midwife kind of talking me through it and telling me when to stop and start because I was really concerned. I think with the whole big baby thing, I was very, very concerned about what impact that would have on recovery and tearing and stuff like that. So I had her do the warm compress and really assist me with the pushing. And after 40 minutes, she was out. And yeah, it's just the most surreal thing. It's hard to, I guess, it feels like such a distant memory and such like a, you know, it doesn't feel real almost, that moment. But yeah, she didn't cry for about 30 seconds to a minute maybe, which I think as like, you know, a first time mum, you're kind of sitting there just waiting to hear that first cry. And even Ben, I look back on the footage that the midwives got on my phone and I could see Ben's face was just like, what's going on? What's going on? But the midwives, as they do, were kind of just like rubbing her down, patting her, and eventually, yeah, she just let out this massive, massive cry. The cord was slightly wrapped around her neck. I had a huge cord, really, really long cord. So that was slightly wrapped around. They fixed that up. And then I just had her on my chest for about an hour and a half after that. And it was, yeah, it was a really beautiful experience. I have nothing bad to say about it at all. I didn't know what to expect from that. And I asked for, is it assisted?
So you had the oxytocin injection into your leg to help with the placenta?
Yeah. I couldn't remember what that was specifically called. But, yeah, because I think in that moment I just wanted to focus on Lucy and I didn't want to really be worrying about that third stage at all. So I had the injection. I don't even remember honestly them getting my placenta out. I think I was just so in my little bubble with my new baby, and that was kind of cut a little bit short, not in a negative way, but once they got my placenta out, I just remember the doctor came up to me and said, we're a little bit worried because you've just had a massive, massive blood clot come out after your placenta. I think they said it was like a 750 mil blood clot that they just caught in one of those dishes. And she said, we're a bit concerned about that. So we're going to need to monitor you quite closely. In the end, it seemed fine. I think it must have just been caught up behind my placenta throughout my pregnancy, and it all kind of shot out at the end. And somehow I only came out of it with just like a small internal graze.
Wow. And how big was she in the end?
She was 4.2 kilos.
Amazing. Beautiful and chunky.
Yeah, big bubba. She was very chunky. I was a huge baby when I was born, so I was always expecting to have a big baby.
Yeah, and those cheeks are just, oh my god, they've been gorgeous from the get-go.
Yeah, she's got, when actually in my scans during pregnancy they were doing like the measurements and it was always her belly that was measuring the biggest on her, and I think that was one of the things in my head. I was like, belly's the squishiest part. If that's the biggest part of her, I can push that out.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Yeah, she's always had a big squishy belly.
I love that, and she's divine. Well, thank you so, so much for sharing your beautiful birth story with us. And I think it's really, really lovely to hear some really positive birth stories that do come with, you know, potentially a slight deviation from what you were looking for. So I think, yeah, it's amazing. And you've been so gracious in sharing here, but also online. I think it's so amazing for people to follow along on your journey and see, you know, the motherhood isn't always amazing at times. It's very raw and real at times. But yeah, we really appreciate it. So where can people find you if they want to follow along on your journey?
Probably Instagram is where I post most frequently and share a lot of my life. So that's just at Erin Rummins. And then I do have a YouTube channel, which I have not been very active on, but my birth vlog is on there. So for people that, I mean, I know when I was pregnant, I was watching hundreds and hundreds of birth vlogs. Yeah. I love them. So yeah, I wanted to make sure I documented my own.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Baby Baking and Kid Raising. If you'd like to suggest a guest or connect and see more of us, then head to Instagram at Baby Baking and Kid Raising. And if you enjoyed this episode, we'd be so grateful if you could hit subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever listening platform you use.
Please note that the information provided in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of a qualified healthcare provider regarding your own pregnancy, birth, and health conditions.